My name is Diana Dunn. I would like to be able to share my New York Times account with my granddaughters. We live in a very rural area. I would like to share my account just to increase their knowledge of our whole world. Thank you so much.
Diana, we heard you.
Introducing the New York Times Family Subscription. One subscription, up to 4 separate logins for anyone in your life. Find out more at nytimes.com/family.
From the New York Times, this is The Interview. I'm David Marchese. Lady Gaga is undoubtedly one of pop culture's great shapeshifters. She's tried on with great success a whole range of different musical styles, from the dance pop of her earliest albums like The Fame. Country rock of Joanne.
Hear my sinner's prayer. I am what I am. And I don't want to break the heart of any other man but you, oh.
To her albums of jazzy duets with the great crooner Tony Bennett.
Who's prepared to pay the price?
Four trips to paradise.
Love for sale.
So when I heard that Gaga's new album, Mayhem, was a return to the pop sounds of her early work, I wondered why a master of reinvention would be making that move. Was it a back-to-the-basics turn, a nostalgia play? Was Lady Gaga revisiting her own earlier style meant to be some sort of meta-comment on what it means to be Lady Gaga? But as she explained it, the answer, in a way, is all of the above. She and I talked about that new album, as well as how her relationship with her fiancé helped shape its music. And we talked, too, about the loneliness of fame and how it's taken her 20 years to learn how to be a boss. Here's my conversation with Lady Gaga.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. It's nice to meet you. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
Yes, it's nice to meet you, too. I'm very happy to be doing this. I'm just making sure all my devices are off. Okay, everything's off.
So in an announcement that I saw for Mayhem, it must have been on social media somewhere, you referred to your fear of going back to the pop music that your earliest fans love. Why is that something you were scared of?
You know, I lived in New York and grew up here my whole life, and I made my artistic way living on the Lower East Side, starting around 17 years old, and really kind of worked the New York music scene as much as I could. Ultimately, that landed me into making The Fame, which was my first studio album. And, you know, that music came out of the culture of people that I was sort of living with at the time. Downtown, I was surrounded by musicians, photographers, artists, club promoters, people that lived and breathed art for a living. It was a community of support. And I think one of the reasons I was afraid is I was so far away now from that community, and not having my community was, you know, was difficult. And I also think I was afraid to return to something that my fans fell in love with early, because it felt very far away, and because it also felt like maybe I would be just like recycling something that I'd done before. But ultimately, I decided I really wanted to do it, and that this sonic style and sonic aesthetic really did belong to me, and it was something that I created. And that was part of the joy of making the album.
How do you characterize that sound for people?
I think that my sound is like an amalgamation of all of the music that helped me fall in love with music. It's got classic rock in it. It has disco in it. It has electronic music in it, 80s synth. It's sort of like all of these memories of music. Something that we did on the album is like we would take the bass, play it live, and then we would actually run it through the analog synths to see how it would sound after guitar parts that would be like indicative of the way Prince would play it or the way David Bowie would play it. I would say it's sort of like picking and choosing my favorite fragments of songs that I love throughout my childhood, and so many different kinds of artists with so many different genres And to me, that is my music. It's everything I love about music, but it's all in one place. And I didn't always do that. I sometimes in my records, like, decided, okay, I'm going to make my version of a country record.
Right, like Joanne.
Like Joanne, right. And, you know, Neil Young was making a record right across the way from me in the same studio. And then I would, like, you know, listen to Harvest Moon and, like, Daydream. And then I would write a song like Joanne. But those records, I think the way that I was sort of, like, bridled to think about women in music, you know, they talk to you a lot about, like, your look and what the aesthetic is for the album and, like, the brand of the music. And that at some point started to affect the way I made music. And I didn't do that.
Yeah, how so?
Well, you know, like with Joanne, I was like, okay, well, since I'm going to do this, like, country folk thing, now I'm going to make sure that each song fits into that theme. Whereas with Mayhem, I didn't do that. With Mayhem, I let each song speak its own language. And that, like, chaos that I have maybe always felt criticized for, I celebrated instead.
And when you said there were ways in which you sort of felt bridled in the way that people thought about women in pop music, what did you mean by that?
It's just the way they talk to you about, you know, who you are. When I had my own kind of image when I moved to Hollywood and was playing my music for Interscope for the first time. And, you know, they have conversations with you about, like, what's your look going to be? And, you know, you're sort of thinking, like, it's going to be me, you know? Well, how are you going to dress? Well, I'm going to wear what I usually wear when I'm on stage performing. And it's just the way they sort of introduce you to start thinking about it as a business as opposed to a performance. So I think a lot of my career in a way was like a retaliation against that. I mean, it's no secret that I loved to make waves with my stage performances and my fashion. But yeah, I think what I was trying to say was that, like, that way of thinking kind of made its way at some point into the way I approached music, and I had to kind of fight it.
Were there ways in which you felt like you were in an exploitative relationship?
You know, were there ever times that I felt like I was being exploited or in an
Just treated as a commodity?
Yes. 100%. I mean, I think what's interesting is I always feel nervous to talk about this because I'm like, I always feel like I want to say that I'm extremely grateful for the career that I've had and all the blessings that have come into my life. And I also can say with, you know, a lot of honesty and truth that being in the music industry since I was a teenager, like, some of it is what you can, like, how much you can stand. It's like how much you are willing to give away of yourself. You know, there were, like, years and years at a time when the normal routine of daily life just goes away. Things like eating at the dinner table with your family is just never happens anymore. And being in a room by yourself never happens anymore. Being sort of carted around and told where to go. I'm sure that must sound like peculiar to people because they see you on top of the world and they think you're the boss. But as a woman in music, I would say it took me 20 years to become the boss. And I am now. And that's thanks to having wonderful people around me, and including my partner, Michael. He really helped me become the boss. And I was not always the boss, but I was the boss of my music. I was the boss of my art. And that was kind of the only thing, you know, because if you strike at the art, then no one gets what they want from you. But yeah, it's interesting. I like wrestle with this, how to talk about it, because yeah, I want to acknowledge all the blessings in my life while also, you know, speaking up for women in this industry that, you know, women, when we're working in the music business, when we're young, you know that there's like no laws around like who can be a producer. And like, if they, like, they're not vetted by anyone. So like when you're 17 years old, and you are invited into a studio, like you have like no protection at all. Like you don't know where you're going. You may not even have an adult in the room with you other than the person that you're working with. It's just, it's not the safest industry.
I'm curious what you made of Chapel Roan's speech at the Grammys, where she talked about sort of the ways in which the record labels are not supporting the artists with, you know, healthcare or living wage.
I think she's a wonderful artist. I think Chapel Roan is like speaking the truth, and she is courageous to do so. And I think we should, for me, I just want to be supportive of her. And I look at what she's been doing and saying and think like, man, I should have like stood up for myself more when I was younger. Cause I hope that will bring more space for her and more boundaries for her in her career to have the career that she wants. I think a woman speaking their mind is a powerful thing. And I was really happy that she did that.
And your partner, Michael Polansky?
Yes.
He's an executive producer on the album?
Yes, he is.
Can you just sort of talk to me about how that role played out for him? Like, what impact does he have on the music?
I mean, Michael was in the studio like every single day with me while I was working. He oversaw the whole process of making the record, completing it, you know, helping me to shape the sound of the record creatively, to trust myself. It was incredibly like kind and beautiful. It's like an amazing thing to do with your partner, you know? Because when I start to doubt myself, like there is nobody that's going to call me on it better than he is.
Do you have an example?
Yeah, actually, there was like one point where I almost turned the whole album into like a grunge record.
And he talked you out of that? I would have listened to that album.
Okay, there's enough. There's like plenty of grunge on the album, but it was right after I did Perfect Celebrity, that song. And I was like, oh, like now everything should be this. And he was like, he said, but there's so much other amazing music that you've made and it's all you. Like, you don't have to try to be something. I thought that was really astute. And I was happy it happened, because very often I will like run with my crazy idea and then look back on it and sometimes regret that change. So yeah, it was really cool.
I could imagine that relationships are tricky for someone in your position, because, you know, you might have questions about someone else's, you know, whether or not their feelings are genuine, or if they have ulterior motives, or, you know, just sort of if they really want to be with you or their idea of who you are. How did you realize that, like, Michael was genuine?
How did I know Michael was genuine? I mean, from the moment that I met Michael, he had the most warm and kind disposition of, like, mostly anyone that I had maybe met in my whole life. And yes, he was impressive. He had like all these businesses that he was running. And but the thing I cared about the most was like he like wanted to know about my family. I'm really sorry to cry.
No, it's okay. Well, I'm sorry.
It's okay to cry on a podcast because no one can see you.
It is you.
He wanted to be my friend. And, it was just, it was something really special. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is I knew Michael was genuine because he wanted to be my friend. Hmm. He wasn't asking to go to things with me or, like, I don't know how to explain it. How do you explain?
No, I understand.
How do you explain the thing that people do that's hard? He didn't want to do any of the things that the other people wanted to do. He wanted to take walks with me. He took me rock climbing. Well, because I also had like a a pain condition that I still have, but he had this belief that I could get better, and he really inspired me to have more hope about it. So, and you know, the truth is, Michael really is like not a fan of the spotlight. He had a really hard time with the cameras when we first started dating, and he kind of got comfortable with it for me so that we could do it together. So, yeah, I guess I know Michael's genuine because he's my friend.
I hope this doesn't sound trite. I don't mean it tritely. I'm very glad that you found that.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad I found it too. It was really hard not having it, you know? It's like not a good feeling to have so much trouble making friends. That was really hard for me over the course of my career. You know, being actually friends with somebody is like, it's like a very specific thing, right? It's like when you can sit in a room together and not talk and read, and you can take long walks and talk about, you know, your family. You can obsess over a new recipe and go to the grocery store and go make it. Like it's friendship is not about like, I don't think it should be transactional, but I think I just was around a lot of that all the time. I was kind of like starved for it. So it's a big blessing that I met someone that was, you know, not like that. And it's good for the music too, you know?
I could imagine that the sort of feeling of contentment might be a feeling that artists can mistrust because of the idea that, great artists created under sort of tense circumstances. Or I'm sure you are aware of albums that people love, and part of the legend of them is that they were recorded when the artist was struggling. Like you're a David Bowie fan, right? You know, and it's like everyone knows he made Station to Station or whatever when he was like, thought he was being chased by witches because he was out of his mind on cocaine and only eating hot peppers and drinking milk, and like his life was insane. He was probably pretty unhappy, but he did make a great album. But we don't have as many cultural legends about when happy artists make great art.
Yeah, I mean, that's the lore, right? And some of it's truth, right? That people say artists make their best work when we're tortured, but I would really like to do away with that. Actually, I think it's super unhealthy for like the world. And I think I've made some of my best work, and I'm happy and healthy, and because I have all my faculties as a musician. I also think that like romanticizing sick artists, it like perpetuates this thing that's super negative, and especially for women. Like I want women to feel like they can be healthy and be happy, that we will celebrate them in their health. But you're right. That is definitely a thing. I feel really grateful that I'm like still here. You know, like, I definitely think that my life could have been very different. Maybe over 5 years ago, I think I was in a really dark place. And I wouldn't say I made my best music during that time at all. So for what it's worth, coming from me, I'm not the only artist that ever lived. But in my experience, the hardest times in my life were not the best music I ever made.
Were there times where you felt like you didn't make something that was authentic to yourself?
I don't know. Sometimes. Maybe like a song here or there. Maybe I was feeling deeply insecure. Or I think Chromatica was really hard for me. That was a very authentic dance record that I'm very proud of. And I loved working on that, but it was just a hard time in my life. I think it's hard to feel deeply authentic when you don't feel well. Cause like you can't like feel the wind at your back. And I just wasn't feeling well. So it was authentic to the time for sure. I wrote all those songs, sang all those songs. But I think that in terms of like being connected to my pure artistic source, I think that there were times when I was feeling healthier that I would probably say those felt more authentic to me.
There are a lot of ways in which I think of your music as, in a way, sort of a comment on authenticity. Have your ideas about what it means to be authentic changed over time?
I think I definitely was like fascinated with artifice when I first started my musical career. And I thought the use of artifice can be incredibly authentic. It's just the way that you do it. I think my understanding of authenticity is that what's changed for me is it has to be on my own terms. It has to be something that I decide, because I think for myself over the years, especially because I started out a career in commenting on artifice, and then I sort of traveled into what's, you know, what some of my fans would even call like normcore with Joanne and A Star Is Born, I think there were some people that thought that that wasn't authentic. So I think what I realized is I have to understand, I have to know my authenticity for myself. And yeah, authenticity to me is a committee of one.
You know, it's, if you look at the history of pop music, like there's not a ton of people who don't end up becoming like, as they get older, don't end up becoming, you know, legacy acts or chasing trends or something like that. Are there people you look to and say like, oh, they forged a trail that looks comfortable for me to go down?
I mean, I think Tony Bennett forged the trail that means the most to me. I mean, you know, Tony always used to tell me, he used to say, just stick with quality, kid. And that made me feel so happy and safe that if I leaned into my artistry, I didn't have to be afraid. And so that's like, I mean, and that's a lot of what this album is for me, is I just leaned into my musicianship hard, like really hard. And I told myself, you know, whatever happens over the next 20 years, 30 years of your career, you're always going to be a musician and you're always going to be an artist and you can always work at it. You can always do more of it. But I think I've definitely like arrived at a place where, you know, achieving world domination into my 90s is like not exactly what makes me tick, you know? And this idea of winning is, I don't know if that's synonymous necessarily always with great music.
Do you feel like you might have a different attitude about the idea of winning if you hadn't already won, in a sense?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I ask myself that question pretty often, actually. Like, how would I look at this differently? You know, am I thinking about this the right way? And, you know, there's just noise sometimes and pressure. But the person that puts the most pressure on me is me. Sometimes I have to warn myself to do something at 70%. Like, don't go 100, because 100 is going to bang you up. Like, I'm getting ready for Coachella, and I'm so, so excited, but I've definitely lost sleep like a whole bunch of nights. And it's just because I want to do a great job, and I'm really hard on myself. And, you know, but it's, I love making people smile. Like, if there's a time and a date where I've been slotted, like, you could make the public smile from, you know, 11 p.m. until 1 in the morning, I really want to make it happen.
You know, I think of your music as celebrating difference, but I wouldn't say in the larger culture right now, it feels like difference is something that's being celebrated. Do you think about how your music fits into the larger culture that you're putting it out into?
You know, I think that people that are different are part of what reminds us all how to love and how to be strong. And it makes me really sad that we live in this world where it's acceptable to hurt other people, to be powerful. But I think during times like these, we have to get louder. And what I wish for people to know is that, like, we can work together to be loud, and we can work together to love each other. And that, like, just because dark people are winning, it doesn't mean that we are invisible or that we are unimportant.
I'm thinking of the Grammys, and when you accepted an award. I think you were the only artist who said something that was explicitly in support of trans rights. Do you see your mission as an artist in 2025 is to, is there a political aspect to it?
I think there's just always been a political aspect to being in the public eye for me. Like, I'm not interested in being famous to stand for nothing at all. It's a privilege to stand with people that are so amazing. I'm in awe of the trans community, and I'm in awe of the LGBTQ plus community, and I have been since I was really young. And if you win an award, like, you have 45 seconds to speak while the world is listening. I just wanted to say something that matters to people that I care about. You know, I'm not a trans person, but I know I try to imagine what it would feel like to wake up living in America and living in the world right now. And I just think being supportive, being kind, and we can't just whisper about these things. We have to say them out loud, I think.
You know, I think kindness is a hugely underrated value. Do you have thoughts about how we might sort of promote or embody, so that it, people see it as the valuable thing that it is?
Look, I'm like not an authority on kindness, but my thoughts, my thoughts are, it's not just about what you put on your Instagram. It's about how you live your life. It's about like how you have conversations with people, who you make an effort to be friends with, to understand the stories of others. It's about in your business, whatever your business is, how do you make sure that all these systems that are around you are operating in kind ways and inclusive ways, ways that celebrate people? To me, that's where kindness has to live. It can't just be something that's like, when people are watching, I'll be kind. You got to be kind all the time.
I want to go back to more like music-specific subjects for a second. Is it harder with the amount of sort of options you have in the studio to know when to stop experimenting? You know, there's one thing if you're sitting with like a little tape recorder on top of your piano and you can only do so much, but when you're actually in a professional studio and the possibilities are kind of endless, how do you figure out when something is ready?
Which takes to use?
Yeah.
It just like, I don't know, like when it sounds right. I know that's like maybe not a great answer, but when it sounds right, I really do see music in my head when I'm working. It like looks like a wall and of colors. And so sometimes when I hear the right like take of something, it just like feels like the wall's complete. And I'm like, that's the one. Sometimes it's visually like a dream, but mostly in the studio, it's a wall. It's a wall of color.
Do you have that experience when you're listening to other people's music?
When I listen to, I think I do. I think it's much stronger when I'm making my own. But yeah, when I listen to other people's music, yeah, I do see colors. Yeah, I do. Like that made me instantly think of Beck. I'm like a huge Beck fan. I'm trying to think of all the colors I've seen listening to Beck. One of the greatest records ever made was, I think, was Morning Phase.
Oh, yeah. The Beck album from, I think it was like 2014.
Yeah, it was like really a special piece of music. It was like, that album to me was like medicine, like audio medicine.
In what way? Why did it affect you at that time?
I think just the way that he used those sounds. I was going through a lot with my fibromyalgia and pain, and I would listen to that album every day to like kind of soothe myself, and I turned it on every single morning. And I remember Rick Rubin was the first person that ever played it for me. He played it for me before it came out, and it was so interesting because I had made Art Pop, and Art Pop was so noisy. And Rick was like, he loved Art Pop, and he was like, let's listen to this Beck record. I want you to hear this. And he played it for me, and it was so like easy to listen to, and it was so beautiful, and just like the guitar sounded like bells, and The strings, like, it's just, it's just a very beautiful piece of music. I like beautiful music. It's funny. I don't know that I always make like very easy listening music, but I like to listen to it.
What other beautiful music do you like?
I like Julian Lage, the guitar player.
Oh, the guitar player.
Yeah.
Oh, huh.
Yeah. And I loved Billie Eilish's album this year. I thought Hit Me Hard and Soft was like a beautiful piece of music.
You made reference a couple times to your fibromyalgia.
Yes.
Is that something that's under control for you right now? Like, what is your relationship with the illness?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, like, for the most part, I'm a lot better, but I still have pain flares. I have one today. So
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm like fine. I just, you know, it just still happens once in a while. And it's like, I'm really grateful that it's not all the time. So yeah, I'm okay.
You know, the music video for Abracadabra is a very, looks to me like a very physically intense music video. Is that something you would have been able to do when the fibromyalgia was less under control?
Well, that was a very physically challenging video to do. I loved every moment of learning the choreography. Paris Goebel's an amazing choreographer. I'm definitely in a place where, like, I'm in the place where, like, even today, if I went to the dance studio, I'd be fine. But yeah, there were years ago where that would have been really, really hard. So yeah, I've just gotten a lot healthier, and but I mean, not to be like too graphic, but like years ago, I used to get a lot more like pinched nerves all over my body. So it would have been a lot harder to do a video like that. I stopped dancing a lot for a while, I think, to make things more manageable for myself. But I'm, you know, kind of back. Feeling good now.
There's a great story, maybe it's apocryphal, that when you were very young, you were playing at some bar in Manhattan, and there were some like loud frat boys there, and they weren't paying attention. Do you know where the story is going?
It feels, yes.
And then the way you got them to pay attention was you basically stripped down to your underwear and performed, and that showed you new possibilities for the kind of artist that you could be. There could be a performance art aspect to what you were going to do. And I am just very curious to know if more recently you've had any other sort of similar artistic epiphanies, or where your own perspective on what you're capable of opened up.
Yeah, I mean, I was like definitely somewhat of an exhibitionist as a young artist, and I like loved it so much. And I was also a big fan of shock art and studied it a lot when I was younger. Like, I thought Spencer Tunick's art was really interesting. I thought Sandy Skoglund's art was really interesting. Marina Abramović's art. And, you know, but I think where I've arrived now in my career is I feel a lot more comfortable and at ease with my artistry. And also, I feel comfortable creating some boundaries around how to prioritize things. Like, I would definitely say for a while in my career, you know, prioritizing, you know, fashion and red carpets, like it feels like it's like a part of your art, but it's also a part of the job. That's usually a part of the job that a lot of the people around you really like. And I would say now I've prioritized that less, and that I'll spend much more of my day playing piano and singing, writing songs, producing. And I don't mean that in a disrespect to like the art of glam, because like I know that my fans know this, that red carpets for me were a place to be artistic during my career.
Yeah, they were a canvas.
They really were a canvas. And I, even though I sometimes like sort of resented the beauty pageantry of it all, because that's not really my thing. The competition of it, I think it's not really my thing. But there is some freedom in going like, okay, I have a red carpet later. But instead of spending my entire day planning for this or weeks planning for this. I'm going to, you know, like make another album or I'm going to work on a new project. Because the reason I'm bringing this up is because I think I felt pulled in so many different directions over the last 20 years. But the place that I feel, where I feel the most happy, is working on my own art. And like, I think the image piece of it, I prefer that a lot more when it's about artistry and it's not about like just about beauty. There's like lots of corsets and dieting and makeup and pressure, and it's like this, you know, and then there's, you know, there's best dress lists, and you know, it's own thing. And I don't mean that to be like disrespectful of it, like I partake in it, but it's that definitely is more challenging. That's like more challenging for me than making like my record. It just feels a little bit further away from like who I am. I guess what I'm saying is these races that women are a part of, it's like, that's not really for me.
After the break, Lady Gaga and I sit down in person and talk about the kind of mom she'd like to be.
I think the thing that's the most important to me is to not force my children to live a life that they are not choosing. Because when they're kids, you know, there's no way for them to understand what fame is and how it will change their lives.
Hey, it's John Chase.
And Mari Uehara.
From Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. Mari, it is gift-giving time.
And we have so many great lists this year.
What's an easy gift for someone like under 50 bucks?
In our gifts under 50 list, I really love this watercolor set from Japan. These beautiful, beautiful colors. It's something that kids can do, adults can do.
I love that. What's like something fun that my dad is going to enjoy?
We have these custom Funko Pops on our Gifts for Dads list. You can custom make a little bobblehead toy in the likeness of your dad. They're totally unserious. They're just silly and fun, and people really love them.
This is so hysterical. I had never seen these before. They're amazing.
I have to admit, I sort of want one myself.
Check out all of Wirecutter's gift recommendations for yourself and everyone else at nytimes.com/holidayguide.
Wait, we still have to talk about the butter warmer.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Do you know the drill here, but you can get pretty close up on these
okay.
microphones, but you just want to...
Do you have much experience with microphones?
No, actually. this is new for me.
But thank you for doing this in person. It's so
Absolutely,
fun.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah.
But we talked earlier about the idea of how there was a point in your career when you were particularly interested in sort of playing with artifice and sort of trying on different personas. And I was wondering if there was any way in which that was ever psychologically destabilizing or hard to manage. You're
yes.
nodding. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but absolutely. At a certain point, I just completely lost touch with reality. I mean, I was falling so deeply into the fantasy of my artwork and my stage persona that I lost touch. I wouldn't say that falling deeper into a life of being a tortured character actually was good for anything.
It worked, though.
I suppose in a way. But I do think there's some people that really liked that side of me. But I didn't like that side of me. And I was really unhappy. And I do feel like I have myself in order now. I went back downtown to a bar that I used to go to all the time last week, I'd go in the middle of the day and I would order a whiskey and a beer. That's where my friends were. That's where my artist community was. But I used to visit and feel really sad, like I was really far away from the person that I was when I was living down there. But this last time that I went, it was, I don't know how to explain it any other way than I just felt like the old me.
Yeah.
And I, losing yourself in your art is, I think, something that's romanticized for sure, but I don't know that it was actually good.
Let me ask you this, though. Do you have any skepticism internally about whether the person you are now is just another persona that you're trying on?
No.
No.
Not anymore. No. But I know why you're asking me that.
Because the I am authentic now is a thing that people do.
I'm sure that does happen. I think it has less to do with, well, okay, let's put it this way. I was authentic before. That was authentically me. I just was authentically splitting off into different personalities all the time. I would say that now, who I would be at dinner with you is who I would be in this interview. So I guess authenticity is subjective. To say that performance isn't authentic is not really true. I just feel like I'm more easily can hold it all and feel confident in the idea that my artistry as a musician is the most valuable thing about me after, of course, what I have to offer my family and my loved ones. Meaning I would not put artifice and fame as high on the list, to go back to your question.
And you brought up a period 5 or so years ago when it seems like your mental health was not in a great place. Are you able to tell me more about what was going on with you then?
Yeah, I mean, well, I had psychosis. So I was not deeply in touch with reality for a while. And it took me out of life in a big way. And after a lot of years of hard work, I got myself back. And it was a really hard time. It was actually really, really special when I met my partner, because when I met Michael, I was in a much better place when I met him. But I remember him saying to me, pretty early on, I know you could be a lot happier than you are. And I was really hard for me to hear him say that, because I didn't want him to think that of me. You know, I wanted him to think I was this happy, just totally together person, and I wasn't really yet. So I guess I mean to share that as a way of saying that I do think it can get better if you are going through a hard mental health time. But it's also something that I have found increasingly harder to talk about. I think I hate feeling defined by it. It's like a ghost of yourself. That's what it felt like to me, like something I felt ashamed of. But I don't think that we should feel ashamed if we go through times like that. And I mostly just wish to say, if you have been through something like that, or you are, it can get better. And it did for me. And I'm really grateful for that.
How did it, were there turning points? How did you turn it around?
I mean, it sort of goes back to what you were saying about playing characters earlier in my career. I had to figure out a way to integrate myself fully with my stage persona and kind of inhabit Lady Gaga's boss energy in my everyday life, but, in an empowered way. And make sense of maybe two things that don't make a ton of sense. I'd like to think that I'm a kind person. But there's like a ferociousness and a hardness and an intensity that I have on stage as a performer. So I think I had to learn how to hold those two things and have them not be at war with each other. And that's actually one of the reasons I named my album Mayhem, because to me, that tension is chaotic.
I was thinking about the title Mayhem,
and I thought, mayhem is, it can be an exciting feeling to visit, but not one you want to live in.
100%. That is a great way of saying it. And yet I live in it. So, I mean, that's
still,
like, well, it's part of my truth. Yeah. It is like always a part of me. It's just, I've learned to hold it and, not like pour gasoline on it. You know, I used to like, just like the more chaos, the better all the time, just living life on the edge constantly. And I'm now proud to be like much more boring.
Before the interview officially started on Tuesday, and we were just making small talk, I mentioned my kids, and you, in a very wistful way, said like, you know, I would love to have kids one day. Yeah. Do you have any apprehension about having kids and still being able to be the Lady Gaga you need to be?
No, I don't. I'm really excited to be a mom. I used to have a lot of apprehension about it. I mean, I think the thing that's the most important to me is to not force my children to live a life that they are not choosing. Because when they're kids, you know, there's no way for me, there's no way for them to understand what fame is and how it will change their lives. So I think the more that we can kind of give them space to discover who they are on their own, I think that's the thing that I believe in the most. I sort of feel as though if our children only understand mommy's job, that's like a very narrow view of life. But then, you know, I also kind of am at war with myself sometimes as I get ready to hopefully become a mom soon, that like, you know, today's wonderful, but like the whole day has revolved around me. You know, like I've been in interviews, like talking about myself all day, and like there's an incredible amount of narcissism in this. And I think as I grow up, I'm kind of like more and more self-aware of that and figuring out how to, like, how do you like live a life where, how do I live a life where I'm passionate about my art while like also removing that from the center of gravity at all times and like making more space for other things. That's something that's on my mind a lot about like my place in the world.
I suspect the only answer is through living it.
Yeah, through living it. And I think also like allowing there to be, you know, holidays, like Mayhem coming out. It's kind of like my birthday. It's like a special day, you know, because I get to deliver all the music, but then maybe there's a time for it to be someone else's holiday.
Any last words? Did I miss anything?
I don't think so. This was great. I've never done anything quite like this before. I just mean that sometimes it can like lean in a direction, or like I can be led into shaping the whole thing, like almost like someone has an idea of me before they talk to me, and then they want that to happen. And
right.
I don't feel like that happened
with you.
So
good.
That was really cool. Thanks for being so cool.
Thank you for being cool, Lady Gaga. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thank you.
That's Lady Gaga. Her new album, Mayhem, is out now. This conversation was produced by Wyatt Orm. It was edited by Annabelle Bacon, mixing by Afim Shapiro. Original music by Dan Powell, Rowan Nemisto, and Marion Lozano. Photography by Philip Montgomery. Our senior booker is Priya Matthew, and Seth Kelly is our senior producer. Our executive producer is Allison Benedict. Special thanks to Rory Walsh, Renan Borelli, Jeffrey Miranda, Nick Pittman, Maddie Masiello, Jake Silverstein, Paula Schumann, and Sam Dolnick.
If you like what you're hearing, follow or subscribe to The Interview wherever you get your podcasts. To read or listen to any of our conversations, you can always go to nytimes.com/theinterview, and you can email us anytime at theinterview@nytimes.com. Next week, Lulu talks with Senator Chuck Schumer. I'm David Marchese, and this is The Interview from The New York Times.